This is an iHeart podcast.
Whatever team Fia is on has a chance to win a championship.
I'm Christina Williams, host of the podcast, In Case You Missed It with Christina Williams. The WNBA playoffs are here, and I've got the inside scoop on everything from key matchups and standout players to the behind-the-scenes moments you won't find anywhere else.
It's really, really hard to be the champions, but we have to remember how it feels and embrace the new challenge that we have.
So listen to In Case You Missed It with Christina Williams, an iHeart Women's Sports production in partnership with Deep Blue Sports and Entertainment on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
And I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media, and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations, thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Ben Ferguson.
And I'm Ted Cruz. Three times a week, we do our podcast, Verdict with Ted Cruz.
Nationwide, we have millions of listeners.
Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we break down the news and bring you behind the scenes, inside the White House, inside the Senate, inside the United States Supreme Court.
And we cover the stories that you're not getting anywhere else.
We arm you with the facts to be able to know and advocate for the truth with your friends and family.
So download Verdict with Ted Cruz now, wherever you get your podcasts.
When I told people I was making a podcast about Benghazi, 9 times out of 10, they called me a masochist, rolled their eyes, or just asked, why?
Benghazi, the truth became a web of lies.
From Prologue Projects and Pushkin Industries, this is Fiasco, Benghazi.
What difference at this point does it make?
Listen to Fiasco, Benghazi on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
With great power comes great responsibility. I think it was Spider-Man's uncle or something like that who said that, but he wasn't wrong, right? In all seriousness, with power comes responsibility. It just does. Especially when it comes to government power and law enforcement power. That comes with the highest level of responsibility. Why? Because if you're someone at the FBI, you have the power because you have so many resources at your disposal. You can put someone through the legal system. You have the power to destroy anyone's life. Think about that. How would you deal with that? How would you deal with having that kind of power? Remember this too. They don't have to end up with a conviction to have your life destroyed. What's the worst crime you think someone can commit? I mean, what, murder, what, rape, robbery, whatever. Pedophilia. Pedophilia is a great one. You know, the FBI has been caught before planting child pornography on people's computers, right? So I want you to picture this. Maybe you're sitting there saying, I don't have to worry about the FBI. I haven't done anything wrong. What if the FBI plants child porn on your computer and charges you? What will happen? How will that work out for you? Well, they'll kick in your door in the middle of the night, wife screaming, kids screaming. They will confiscate your computer. It'll take about, 15 seconds for every single friend and family member to know the FBI has confiscated your computers and they're charging you with horrific child pornography. You will need a lawyer, most definitely. Probably cost you, I would guess, $500,000 to $1 million to challenge the FBI. Because remember, you're innocent. During the year you're going through trial and pre-trial, your wife is being barraged by messages and public posts that her husband's some kind of child pedo. She probably will leave you. If she doesn't leave you, you'll have to quit your job, guaranteed. She'll have to quit hers if she has one. Kids won't be able to go to school anymore. You and your family will most definitely have to leave town, possibly even change your name. Keep in mind, you're completely innocent. And maybe at the end of this year, 2-year endeavor, maybe that jury comes back and says, what? The FBI planted that. No, not guilty. Not guilty, huh? you're still $1 million poorer. Do you have $1 million? Your wife, she's off with someone else now. Your kids, hopefully they'll forgive you, but you lost 2 years of them. You don't have your job, you don't have your home, you don't have your neighborhood. That's power. The FBI could do that to you tomorrow, like that. That's power. So if we have an FBI that is now a communist activist organization, setting up people on the right, attacking the political opponents of Democrats, that's the most dangerous thing happening in the United States of America by a mile because of the power they hold in their hands. January 6th. I know you saw all the coverage on TV. You do know the FBI was involved in that, right? I mean, you know the FBI, other federal organizations, they instigated that thing. If not 100% of it, at least a good portion of it. Don't believe me? Oh, don't worry. We'll have videotape showing that to you. It's on videotape. We'll talk to Darren Beatty about that here. Darren Beatty's going to tell you some jaw-dropping things about what took place on January 6th, things you've never heard of before, with pictures, videotape. We're not talking about internet conspiracy theory land. We're talking about, in reality, it's sure looking more and more like the federal government caused January 6th to happen on purpose to justify a government crackdown on political opponents of the Democrats. Are you worried enough yet? And look, let's not do this thing where we act like everything's brand new. And I've made this mistake 100 times. I know you probably have too. I can't believe the FBI's corrupt now. The FBI's corrupt now. For a long, long time, the Federal Bureau of Investigation has taken that power, that incredible power they have, and they have abused it. And they've abused it without consequences. They've abused it without end. And because there aren't ever really consequences at all, they continue to do it. You do remember Ruby Ridge, right? A lot of people don't think about it. They don't remember it. They don't even know when it is. Oh, was that in the 50s or the 80s? That Ruby Ridge was in the 90s. Randy Weaver? Randy Weaver was a man. He was a Green Beret. Special Forces. Randy Weaver was a man who loved the United States of America, wanted to serve the United States of America, saw plenty of things in his life that led him to very much distrust the United States of America. So what did Randy Weaver do? Separated himself. Hey, I'm gone. Hey, I don't want to be part of any of this anymore. Randy Weaver found himself in the mountains. Himself, his family, just became one of those guys who could grow his own food, kill his own food, his own water, just one of those off-the-grid guys. Bunch of them up where I grew up in Montana, too. They call them all militias, you know. They're Nazis, they're white supremacists. Some are, some aren't. I don't know. I don't go to the meetings. But this is a common thing, especially in places like Montana and Idaho and elsewhere. So Randy Weaver starts going to various meetings of various guys who are not happy with the U.S. government. They think their government's corrupt and broken, and I mean, you could certainly make an argument for those things. The feds send somebody to Randy Weaver. Randy Weaver doesn't approach anybody. The feds send somebody to Randy Weaver, and this somebody, this federal informant, tells Randy Weaver to saw off a shotgun. That's it. You ever heard of a sawed-off shotgun? Maybe you've handled one yourself. You take the barrel of a shotgun and you reduce the length of it. Now, what that does is it reduces the range of the shotgun, but if you're close enough, makes a big old mess because those pellets come out and they just... It's an ugly bit of business. Well, of course, the federal government has somehow decided that's their business and they've made it illegal to saw off too much. So a federal informant approached Randy Weaver and had him do this. And then the feds decided to charge Randy Weaver with a crime after clearly entrapping the man. That's entrapment. You can't do that. It's against the law. They charged him with a crime. Randy told him to go pound sand. What did they do? Did they let it go? Did they dismiss it? Did they wait for a good time to approach Randy Weaver, maybe talk to him about it? No. They sent heavily armed federal agents out to his land where they would have weapons, spy on him regularly. Randy Weaver's out hunting one day with his son and his dog, and they come across heavily armed men on their property. What would you do if you took your dog for a walk on your property and found heavily armed men there and your dog barking and going after them? Well, a gunfight ensued. By the time Ruby Ridge was done, Randy Weaver's wife was dead, his dog was dead, son was dead. You know how many people at the FBI went to jail over that? None. Well, one guy in the end, some paper pusher in D.C. went to jail for obstruction of justice a year or something a year later, but no one held to account. No one who pulled the trigger, no one who killed that guy's son, his dog, his wife, nobody. Waco might even be worse. Okay, so there's some weirdo cult in Waco, Texas. Weird cult, very David Koresh, very odd human being, and like all cults, you know, you're going to attract the dregs of society, people lost looking for answers, and that's really what it was. They were just a poor cult. They didn't have any money. They were half of people were starving to death, and they were out at some big complex in Waco, Texas, and the federal government decided they wanted him arrested. Well, David Koresh was not exactly a hermit. He wasn't hidden in a bunker out there. He was a man, he'd go to town, he'd go for a run, he'd go out and about. There were 1,000 peaceful ways they could have done it. Instead, they chose to surround and assault the property. By the time they were done, who knows how many women and children had burned to death, died of smoke inhalation, shot by the ATF and FBI. The feds were so upset with what they'd done, they all posed for pictures in the ashes of the dead children, and to this day, they will post those pictures on social media bragging about a job well done. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has the power to destroy your life without you having done a single thing wrong. With that kind of power comes gigantic responsibility. And if that organization is now the weaponized arm of the Democratic Party, we are in very deep trouble. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I'm right. We're going to talk to a former undercover agent, and we'll ask him about Ruby Ridge, Waco, next. To talk to an undercover agent now. Gosh, that's so freaking cool. Joining me now, John Legato, veteran FBI undercover agent, host, of course, of the John Legato Show podcast and author of the book, The Comey Gang. If you want to know just how dirty it is in the FBI, highly recommend it. John, all right, before we get to Ruby Ridge and Waco and all the other stuff, just please tell me it was so cool being an undercover agent. That's awesome.
You know, it really was cool. In fact, when they ended the case, I was begging to continue it because my last backstopping, I was a silent owner of a high-end gentleman's club, and I had been doing that for 4 years. So, you know, plus I'm Italian, and the mafia feeds you well.
No, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm saying I had great food. I ate good for 4 years.
You ate good in a gentleman's club for 4 years and got paid for doing it. Well done, John. All right, Ruby Ridge. A lot of people, unbelievably, a lot of people aren't aware of Ruby Ridge, or they're aware of Al. There was some scandal. What was that, the 70s? But for people 90s. Who've never heard, don't know what the story is, what was the story of Ruby Ridge?
It was a horrible story. What happened, I don't know if you remember, is Al Gore was trying to organize the government. So ATF was afraid they were going to get picked up by the FBI and be part of the FBI. So they wanted to do something, you know, big. So Ruby Ridge was this guy named Randy Weaver. He was a former Green Beret. He was a survivalist. And what Randy wanted to do, he was in guns. He was in the Aryan Nation Brotherhood in near Naples, Idaho. Which that whole area was preppers and Christian fundamentalists and John Birchers. And it wasn't unusual to have guns in that section of the country. So the ATF rolls this guy, I think, Fadley, and they say, you got to get us Randy Weaver. Now, what people don't know is this Fadley goes to Weaver and meets him at a Aryan Nation meeting and says, look, Randy, I need to buy some weapons, sawed-off shotguns. So Randy says, yeah, okay. So he cut down a shotgun. And the problem is when he sold it back to this Fadley, it was not legal or illegal. They by a half an inch or something. So ATF says, listen, this isn't illegal. You have to go get him to saw off more of the shotgun. So he did. And they had a warrant for Randy. And what happened next was a beginning of a series of events that never should have happened.
John, how do we get from what you just described, which honestly, that alone is just, it's awful to sound, but how do we get from what you just described to a dead dog, a dead wife, a dead son? That it just seems like a million miles away from what you just described. How did we get there?
Well, slowly. But first of all, it was entrapment. Entrapment, basically, without getting deep into weeds, is making somebody do something they normally wouldn't do. So would Randy Weaver be in guns? Well, first of all, you know, when the informant asked him to do it, he asked him to saw it off. So you have a problem right there. I mean, if you, the best way I can explain entrapment is, say that I'm dealing with a fence for 10 years, I'm selling them stolen goods. And I come to them one day and said, I need drugs. And they say to me, I don't deal drugs, I just deal in stolen goods. And I say, well, I'll give you $100,000 for 2 kilos. And they do it. That's entrapment. I made them do something they normally wouldn't do. They were fence, you know, they dealt in stolen goods, they didn't deal in drugs. So the premise for this whole thing was entrapment. And that's why basically the only person who went to jail was a person who never stepped foot at Ruby Ridge, which was a good friend of mine by the name of Mike Vejo. But what happened is the marshals indicted him, or they issued a warrant. He didn't show up for the gun charges, and then they issued a bench warrant. And the marshal services was doing reconnaissance every day on his property. And one day, Randy Weaver was out there with a friend named Harris, his son, and a dog. And they ran into the marshals. And it's debatable. They still don't know who shot first, but it doesn't really matter. They killed Weaver's son, the dog, and wounded this Harris. And so begot Ruby Ridge. That was the beginning of Ruby Ridge.
How'd it end?
Well, it ended horribly, because what happened was the rules of engagement. So ATF takes the lead, and they surround the place, and the marshals surround the place. And just like in Waco, they call the FBI hostage rescue team in. So this Mike Vejo is a high-level bureau official in Washington. He gets a call, Mike, we need you to be the logistician on this Ruby Ridge thing. We need so many toilets, so much this, so much food. So that was his job. So keep that in mind. So they surround the place, and ATF doesn't know what they're doing when it comes to sort of sieges and hostage negotiations. They're not prepared for that. So the FBI takes over. So the assistant director was Larry Potts, and he's flying to Ruby Ridge, and they're talking about the rules of engagement. Our rules of engagement have always been, you can kill someone if your life is in danger or somebody else's. About the fourth or fifth day of the siege, somebody, and it had to be Larry Potts or the FBI commander on site, changes the rules of engagement to shoot any male with a weapon that they see. Now, there were other SWAT teams up there, and there was police officers from SWAT teams from different municipalities. When they got those rules of engagement, they said, this isn't right. This isn't right. This isn't what we do. Some of them refused to do it. But what happened is at the point that Randy Weaver came out, their helicopters were going by, and Randy Weaver came out, with his friend Harris, and they had guns. They weren't shooting at the helicopter. So our sniper, Lon Herucci, shot. The first shot, I think, hit Randy Weaver, and they were running back into the cabin, and he took a second shot, and it hit Harris, but it went through and shot Randy Weaver's wife, Vicky, in the head as she was holding the baby.
Good grief.
So now you got a real, you know, crap storm, because the rules of engagement, somebody changed the rules of engagement. I know who did it. I mean, because Mike Vehu told me, and he knew it. But that was the big issue up there. That and ATF wanted to, you know, didn't want to get swallowed up into the FBI, so they wanted something big. And the result was this. Randy Weaver got a lot of money. Nobody went there. Randy Weaver didn't go to jail. Harris didn't go to jail. Or they killed the marshal. Somebody killed the marshal the first day. They were charged with murder. They were charged with, you know, conspiracy, guns. The only thing Randy Weaver got in trouble for at the end of this, after getting several million dollars, was his failure to report to the court. That was it. All the other, Harris and everybody else, they sued and they got money. So that tells you that there was a big, major screw-up.
Anybody get in trouble with the FBI?
One person. My buddy, Mike Vehu. And here's what happened to Mike Vehu. This isn't known. So Mike Vehu is back at headquarters. He never left D.C. So after this all happened, the on-site commander was Eugene Glenn, who was a good guy. So they called this big meeting in Washington with the FBI and all the people that were involved in Ruby Ridge. And the day of the meeting, now Mike Vehu is just a logistician. Larry Potts was supposed to be there, and the on-scene commander, HRT guy. They come in to meet with Mike Vehu before the meeting, and they said, "We're taking a sick leave. You take the meeting." So all of a sudden, you had Eugene Glenn and the SWAT guy and the marshals, and they're saying, "Mike, who gave the change of the rules of engagement?" And Mike said, "I don't know." So Eugene Glenn, who was the SAC there, got reprimanded. So they asked Mike, they said, "Mike, you do an after-action report." He said, "I wasn't even there." Well, they said, "You do an after-action report." So he does an after-action report, and he didn't like the way it looked, but it was typed up, it was in the computer, I guess, and he tossed it. So a year later, they come up to Mike and say, "Listen, we have you on obstruction of justice. We want you to turn in the person that changed the rules of engagement, or you're going to jail." And Mike Vehu said, "I don't know." I think he did know. And he went to jail. He went to jail for obstruction. He actually went to prison. The only man that wasn't there, the only man that had nothing to do with anything other than that piece of paper. And they said, "If you give us who changed the rules of engagement, we'll let you go." And poor Mike Vehu, to his death, I've talked to him many times. I've done some interviews with him, and he just passed away. But he was a good man. He was innocent, and he should have never suffered like he did for some bureaucrats.
Who changed the rules of engagement?
It was a high-up person. It was a very high-up person.
All right. Then let's switch gears here. Waco, it sounds like they're unconnected, or people don't realize that there is some sort of a common thread through these things. But okay, some wing nut has a little weirdo cult in Waco, Texas. How does that end up with a bunch of children being burned to ash?
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so we have Ruby Ridge, and I think Waco was a few months, 6-8 months after. So ATF took a lot of heat over Ruby Ridge. So they have information that of this cult, but this cult wasn't bothering anybody. They had guns. They reported that they had tons of guns. It came out later, they had like 76 guns. But someone said, and we don't even know who at this point, that they were transitioning semi-automatics into automatic weapons, hence ATF got a search warrant. Now here's the crazy thing, and people don't know this. Every day, David Koresh would go for a jog outside the compound. Every day. So ATF, all they had to do, now, if I was running that operation, why not snatch him up while he's running and get him, you know, we'll execute the warrant. What they wanted is they called the news media because they needed to get back at the good graces of the public. And a mailman passes by, you know, like 2 miles from the compound, like, you know, hundreds of vehicles and people, and he's delivering mail, and he knocks on the door of the compound, and David Koresh opens. He said, hey, there's like a million federal officers down the road here. So they knew they were coming. They did not have to execute the warrant in the way they did, but they wanted the publicity. All they had to do was grab Koresh on his morning run. That's all they had to do.
Okay, so Janet Reno, what's her connection to all this?
She was brand new. I had lunch with her after Ruby Ridge. She was brand new as the Attorney General. She told me she was getting misinformation. She wasn't getting the complete information on what was going on at Waco. So what they said, and actually the government was exonerated after many, many investigations. I had a classmate from the FBI Academy that was a hostage negotiator, and he would call me up after negotiations with Koresh, and he'd play some of the negotiation. Koresh was wounded at this time. He was losing blood. He was delirious, and you could not even understand him. He was talking about the seven levels of something religious. He was, you know, just out of it. The only problem is they gassed the thing. There's accusations that they killed the children with gas. I don't know about that. But who set the fires was Koresh, or was the Branch Davidians.
Okay, so do you think the Branch Davidians killed those kids? How'd the kids die?
Well, in the fire. Look, Koresh was a pervert. And he was a musician. I don't know if the two go together. I'm sorry if I... but he was both those things. And he was ordering, you know, who he would have sex with. I mean, he told husband and wives, you can't have sex with anymore. And there is an accusation he was having sex with underage children. I don't know if that was pretty strong. But he was a pervert in terms of, you know, this cult he was having. And he was just, at the end, the bottom line was that he forced it. He was lighting the fires. Because the FBI had microphones in there, and you can hear clearly the Davidian saying, put the fire over here, or light the fire over here. The tank thing, I don't know. You know, I would have just waited them out. I would have just waited. And I think that's the new method, the new rules of engagement on that type of... Just wait them out. They're in there. I mean, why do you got to shoot at them, especially with children? I never understood the sort of have to go in and clear it. I mean, I was a Marine in Vietnam. It's one thing if people are shooting at you, but the Davidians during the siege were just in there. I mean, they were starving. They were, you know, talking. They had conversations with the Bureau. But to attack them made no sense. They would have come out eventually. They would, you know, they had to come out eventually.
John, thank you so much, man. I appreciate you.
Excuse me?
I said thank you so much. I appreciate you very much.
Well, Jesse, yeah, Semper Fi to you, and thanks for having me.
Semper Fi, sir. Daggone Marine in Vietnam. That's a good man right there. All right. Darren Beatty, January 6th. The FBI involved in January 6th? Hang on.
We need to go into the Capitol!
Hang on!
Into the Capitol!
What?
Peacefully!
Fed! 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 Peacefully!
Okay, folks, number one, as soon as the president's done speaking, we go to the Capitol. The Capitol's this direction. USA! 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 USA!
wonder who that guy is. Joining me now, the founder of Revolver News, guy who's been all over this and many other things, Darren Beatty. Darren, who's Ray Epps? Who is that gentleman who wants to go in the Capitol?
You know, that's a great question. What I can say is Ray Epps is the only individual in the mountains of January 6th video footage who's caught repeatedly, insistently, emphatically urging people to go into the Capitol as early as January 5th. And to the best of my knowledge, he's the first person and one of the handful of people at all who's caught pronouncing this mission to go into the Capitol that far in advance. His behavior was so egregious that he was one of the first 20 people listed on the FBI most wanted list for January 6th. He was a star player in the New York Times' video documentary, Day of Rage, and depicted as one of the handful of people who knew about the Capitol siege in advance. But now, curiously, amazingly, everything has reversed. And he is the only, not only is he unarrested, unindicted, he is the only January 6th riot participant about whom Adam Kinzinger will have nice things to say, and about whom the New York Times will write a dedicated full puff piece. It's a very strange affair, and I'm happy to talk more about it.
Oh, I would love for you to talk more about it, because, boy, I noticed that, what was that, yesterday or the day before? I don't remember. Maybe it was last week. Who knows? The New York Times, it wasn't just a little article either. I had my guys print it off because I wanted to read it. It was like 10,000 words on what a saint this poor Ray Epps is, who's been attacked by the right. Boy, why would the New York Times fall in love with this guy so much? I do wonder, Darren.
You know, that's a fantastic question. And it's really so bizarre, because he really is such a smoking gun of this Fed's erection. You would think, why renew public attention on this guy at all by featuring him in this New York Times piece? I suspect it's a damage control effort for still more inconvenient evidence coming out in the near future, possibly. But it really is remarkable. And there are three things that I'd like to note about this New York Times piece. One, the whole piece is a sympathy puff piece, yet it contains no blanket explicit denial that Epps was acting at the direction of any government agency. The reason this is interesting is that Ray Epps, through his lawyer, who incidentally is a 9-year veteran of the Phoenix FBI field office, through his lawyer, issued a statement to the January 6th committee, as reported by the committee, saying he is not part of the FBI and he has never been a member of a law enforcement agency. And the denial kept curiously leaning on the specific formulation that included law enforcement agency. Now, this would leave open, for instance, the Department of Homeland Security, military intelligence, Joint Terrorism Task Force, and so forth. And in an interview with Epps' lawyer conducted by the Epoch Times, I believe, the interviewer asked the lawyer, so what is it with all these allegations? The lawyer said, unequivocally, Epps is not FBI. He's not an FBI informant, unequivocally. And then the follow-up question was, well, was he acting at the direction of any U.S. government agency, intelligence, law enforcement, or otherwise? And the response to that, by contrast, was, not to my knowledge. So the New York Times piece did not clear the record on that and offer any blanket denial. It simply repeated this legalistic denial of being involved with law enforcement. Number two, the New York Times piece describes Epps as a Trump supporter who just went to Washington to defend Trump. And in fact, it was just a last minute deal. Ray Epps and his son decided on a whim to go from Arizona to Washington, D.C., because they wanted to hear Trump's speech on election fraud. Well, the piece amazingly, really criminally from a journalistic standpoint, fails to inform the reader that Ray Epps did not even go to Trump's speech. So Ray Epps, the alleged Trump supporter, travels all the way from Arizona to D.C. to listen to this speech, and he doesn't go to the speech. And instead, he sort of orchestrates the movement of people to the Capitol to follow up on his bizarre exhortations to crowds to go into the Capitol the night before. And he just happens to be conveniently pre-positioned right by the initial and decisive breach point on the west side of the Capitol before Trump is even finished speaking. And the New York Times doesn't ask, well, you say you went to just watch the speech on a last minute whim. Why didn't you go to the speech? Times doesn't ask that. And finally, and most importantly, and most amazingly from the standpoint of this really sloppy mop-up janitorial operation that the New York Times attempted to conduct, the Times doesn't even explore the question of, where did you get the idea in the first place, Ray Epps? You're the first person on camera repeatedly, insistently urging people to go into the Capitol, and the reception of your exhortation was so strange. People thought your behavior was so strange, so bizarre, so out of place that they immediately accused you of being a Fed, and you were not deterred. In fact, you kept insisting that people go into the Capitol. So where did you get this idea in the first place, and why were you so vigorously insistent upon it despite the sub-zero buying temperature of the crowd when you first proposed this idea? And the New York Times piece will say, oh, what a poor guy, he's a victim of these conspiracy theories, but it won't ask those absolutely critical, fundamental, obvious core questions. It really is an embarrassment, even by New York Times standards.
And that is saying something, because New York Times has some low standards. But you know, he's not alone, Darren, when it comes to January 6th. Who's fence cutter bulwark? Who's the scaffold commander? Who are these people? What is with these names? Who are these people?
You know, that's a fantastic question, Jesse. And really, the video is what says it all. And so I urge everyone, go to revolver.news, click on our January 6th series, read all of it, but in particular the two-part series on Ray Epps. And the reading is great, but the video really says it all. And the individuals that you mentioned, again, these are individuals who are pre-positioned at that initial breach point before the Proud Boys even arrived there. And that's critical, because the Proud Boys, according to the official narrative, are the fall guys. They're what kicked everything off. The Proud Boys kicked off that initial breach on the west side of the Capitol. Not really. The video footage shows that there are people hanging out at that initial breach point before the Proud Boys got there, and the people hanging out there ended up having real critical, decisive roles in allowing the rally to turn into a riot. So one individual you mentioned, fence cutter Bulwark, he's caught on camera methodically removing fencing such that when the, you know, this is during Trump's speech. So when the crowd finally gets to the Capitol after Trump's speech, all of the fencing is gone, so the people don't even know that they're entering restricted territory. That's why this is such a critical move, of people removing fencing in advance of the arrival of the main crowd. The other individual, scaffold commander, plays a critical role. He's there, he's also removing fencing as Trump is speaking, but he finds a way to position himself at the top of that scaffolding, the top of that tower that I guess was there because of the Biden's inauguration coming up. And he, with his bullhorn, was repeatedly, constantly, incessantly, for hours, belching out to the crowd saying, move forward, we need your help, move forward. Now think about this as a matter of basic crowd psychology. You go, you hear Trump speech as they're doing all these shenanigans, they're preparing the booby trap in advance. Then you head over to the Capitol, you don't see any fencing, so you don't even know that you're technically committing a crime going on Capitol grounds, restricted grounds. Then you hear this booming, incessant, authoritative voice saying, move forward, we need your help. You don't know if there was some kind of medical emergency and someone's directing the crowd to make ways for, you know, medical professionals to provide assistance. You don't know anything. Maybe you're not even thinking about it, and just as a matter of basic conditioning, you hear move forward over and over, and anyone moves forward, just the nature of you know, the Brownian motion, so to speak, of crowds is such that if the front moves forward, everyone moves forward. This guy kept saying move forward. And then when the Capitol was actually breached and people started going into the Capitol, immediately the same scaffold commander kept saying, go into the Capitol, go into the Capitol, fill the Capitol, fill the bleachers, go in, help your friend over the fence, help your friend over here. And it was so methodical, it was so essential to everything that was happening. And yet, unlike Epps, this scaffold commander, Northwest Scaffold Commander, as he's known by researchers, not only is he not arrested, he's not on the FBI most wanted, he hasn't even been identified. And you would think with the full resources of the U.S. government, they would at least go to the effort of figuring out who this guy is. And the question is, if they already know who he is, why the hell hasn't he been arrested? Because I would say, you know, Ray Epps's behavior is sort of more fit for prime time. There's such a sort of natural virality to his behavior of saying go into the Capitol. But in an objective terms, I would say Northwest Scaffold Commander's at least as egregious as Ray Epps in terms of his behavior, at least as suspicious. And unlike Ray Epps, as I mentioned, he hasn't even been identified.
I want to encourage everybody to go to Revolver and pick apart everything Darren has done on this. It really is incredible journalism work. Darren, just, I'm going to ask you something I shouldn't ask you, but you're the expert's expert. You collect all this evidence, all this video, all this. You've been digging into this stuff for so long. What do you believe the Fed's role in January 6th was? I'm asking you for an opinion, no more of your journalism stuff. What's your opinion? What do you believe they did?
You know, that's such an important question, and there are different, you know, tiers to how I could answer that. I mean, the fact that I'm comfortable calling this a Fed's erection suggests that at the very least, the Feds kind of knew what was going to go down and let it happen, and that there was a subset of operators that in all likelihood included Epps, included Scaffold Commander, were not authentic actors on that day. And so even if they weren't taking a direct paycheck from the FBI, they could have been working at the direction of some government agency or cut out of that agency, and really played a critical role in creating that booby trap to create the kind of physical and crowd psychological conditions for that to turn into what it turned into. And that I'm comfortable saying with extreme confidence. But as to the precise configuration, I think that's a very interesting question. And you have to go back, I think, to the nature of sort of government involvement in these affairs. Really, you know, goes back a long way, but I'm thinking back to the 90s with all of the government operations to infiltrate militia groups and to infiltrate crowds. And actually, Merrick Garland was a big part of that. He had the domestic extremism profile in the Bill Clinton's White House. And so there's a deeper history to how all of this plays out. In my personal opinion, Epps was probably some type of, you know, on and on operative. But again, the configuration remains obscure as to, you know, how these networks actually work. I think part of the reason Ray Epps was caught with his pants down, so to speak, is probably due to his age. You know, as someone of that age who may have been, you know, involved in operations, it's like your software isn't your software does not reflect the fact that people are holding phones and recording you at all times. And I think it's kind of interesting. And I think these types of operations were a lot easier to get away with before the kind of the cell phone age that allowed for ubiquitous recording, and also the internet age, which allowed for kind of the mass dissemination of those recordings. And I think someone like Epps, although obviously he knew that cell phones existed, it's just it didn't filter into his sort of instinctual operational sense that, look, man, you're being recorded. He was on a live stream on January 5th, and there, I think there's one part of the live stream where Epps sort of like makes a joke about the live stream that reflects the fact he doesn't really quite understand what it is. And so I think the kind of Ray Epps moment, in my opinion, is made possible by the fact that Epps was conducting a kind of an operation along the lines of what may have happened in the past, but wasn't conducting himself with the kind of operational security that is appropriate for the age of cell phones and internet. And we're the lucky ones, I guess, because at least we have a glimmer of what actually January 6th was all about. And it's very important because there's so much at stake here. And I think that's also important to keep in mind. The government and the regime, they're using the false narrative of January 6th as a pretext to reconfigure the entire national security apparatus against the American people for political reasons, to politically target the energies associated with movements like the Trump movement. And that's why this is so dangerous.
Wow, that is truly dangerous. Darren, go read all his stuff. Thank you, my brother. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
All right, we got final thoughts. Next. Look, I care about so many of the issues facing this country. So many of the things you care about, inflation, gas prices, open borders, all that. These are all incredibly important things. The culture war stuff, stuff we talk about all the time. I care like you care. I'm with you. Those aren't the most dangerous things happening in this country. The Federal Bureau of Investigation being a bunch of activist Democrats, that's the most dangerous thing going on in the country because they have the power to destroy your life. They can destroy the life of the President of the United States all the way down to you and everyone in between. That has to be stopped. All right, we'll do it again.
Whatever team Fee is on has a chance to win a championship.
I'm Christina Williams, host of the podcast In Case You Missed It with Christina Williams. The WNBA playoffs are here, and I've got the inside scoop on everything from key matchups and standout players to the behind-the-scenes moments you won't find anywhere else.
It's really, really hard to be the champions, but we have to remember how it feels and embrace the new challenge that we have.
So listen to In Case You Missed It with Christina Williams, an iHeart Women's Sports production in partnership with Deep Blue Sports and Entertainment on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
And I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media, and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations, thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Ben Ferguson.
And I'm Ted Cruz. Three times a week, we do our podcast, Verdict with Ted Cruz.
Nationwide, we have millions of listeners.
Every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we break down the news and bring you behind the scenes, inside the White House, inside the Senate, inside the United States Supreme Court.
And we cover the stories that you're not getting anywhere else.
We arm you with the facts to be able to know and advocate for the truth with your friends and family.
So download Verdict with Ted Cruz now, wherever you get your podcasts.
What I told people, I was making a podcast about Benghazi. 9 times out of 10, they called me a masochist, rolled their eyes, or just asked, why?
Benghazi, the truth became a web of lies.
From Prologue Projects and Pushkin Industries, this is Fiasco, Benghazi.
What difference at this point does it make?
Listen to Fiasco, Benghazi on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an iHeart podcast.